Hello, everyone, and welcome back to No Earthly Explanation. This is the podcast where we just dive into the things that are unexplainable. For those of you that are new to listening, I'm your scientific host, Ellie Ringo of Ellie Knows Rocks. And with me is our investigative host, the ever brilliant Don Schmidt. How are you doing today, Don?
I am great, Ellie. Always good to be with you. And as we certainly are approaching, you know, that time of year that everyone is distracted and with family situations and hustle and bustle, shopping and everything, we bring things back down to earth, so to speak, with these mysteries that still befuddle and confuse, but always, you know, enlighten us in the search for answers. And that's why I'm especially, you know, excited about tonight's guest, because it's something that touches all of us, something that whether you know someone who's had such an experience, or just the very curiosity of what is beyond, you know, this earthly realm, so to speak. And whether in my case, where I was raised in a parochial school, and it's always, you know, in the back of your mind, the idea that when you lose a loved one, are they still there? Mm-hmm. Are they still, you know, looking over your shoulder? Do we have a guardian angel? Do we have someone watching out over us? And then as we approach or we have near-death experiences, you know, the fact that there's this common bond that they describe, the same situation almost over and over again. And that's what I love about it, because mm-hmm. that's what science is, as you know, above all else, that it's a duplication of effort, duplication of patterns. Mm-hmm. And that's certainly what, you know, the subject will be this evening.
Yeah, no, for sure. I mean, I have loved ones. My dad, in fact, he went through something just horrible. He was having a very routine cryo surgery, and he actually died for a minute, and he was on the table, and he said all that he said, he felt like he was out of his body. He said he could see the entire operating room. He could see the doctors. He could see everybody freaking out, and it lasted just mere seconds. And then he said, all of a sudden I was jolted back into my body. And so it was very scary. And so without further ado, everybody, our guest this evening is pretty remarkable. His name is Peter Panagor, and he has survived a near-death experience, and he's written a book about it. And so please give a big welcome to Peter. Peter, how are you?
Excellent, Ellie. Hi, Don. Thanks for having me here tonight. Appreciate it.
Oh, yeah. Our pleasure. Our pleasure.
Mm-hmm. So for everybody who doesn't know who you are, could you tell us a little bit about you, your story, how your near-death experience came to be, and kind of why you want to educate people on it?
My name is Peter Panagor. I am an ex-reverend of the United Church of Christ, but I was never a believer because I died when I was 21 ice climbing, and I hid inside the church in order to pursue my interior journey and be of service. I recognized that the universality of love, the universality of humanity's inner sparkle, and that all came about because when I was 21, I went snow caving for 10 days in British Columbia and Alberta, and ice climbing, and I died ice climbing. I died of hypothermia. I made a mistake. It cascaded into an event, and the event eventually killed me. And at the end of it all, I chose to come back and live this life. And I could tell you what happened when I was dead. Some of it anyway, it was hours and hours. I spent a long time dead, but a short time according to my body. The whole event, the whole experience was long, but the actual
time was different.
Time was totally different.
Wow. And so go ahead, Don.
Oh, I was just going to ask for suffering the hypothermia and the frostbite. I mean, you died, you were ice climbing and you dropped, you were suspended, you were hanging as far as in midair. About how long did they, your teammates, how long did they tell you you were actually, you know, in such a precarious situation until they arrived to help?
Well, I only had one climbing partner and no one arrived to help. And we ended up self-rescuing. Tim, my partner, never told me how long he thought I was dead, but he was pretty sure I was, because when I came back, he was screaming and yelling at me, "Don't die.
Don't die."
My gosh. Did you have any, frostbite sort of damage to any fingers?
I wear half gloves. It hits 50 degrees. Uh-huh. I wear half gloves. I can't feel my big toe. Yep. I have all sorts of cold related things.
Wow, that's insane. So was
but you do have feeling in your feeling in your hand.
I do. I have feelings in my hand. I have a lot of damage. I have a lot of damage, but I still have feeling in all my fingers.
We just quickly mention, we were checking out at a department store on one occasion, and it was the middle of the summer, and the gentleman was wearing full gloves, and we could see that he was having extreme difficulty in just taking money out of his wallet. And my wife quickly volunteered to help. And he mentioned that he had suffered severe frostbite in both of his hands. And he had lost all feeling in his hands. So, and for living in Wisconsin and for having experienced my ears, my fingertips, they're always highly susceptible. They're forever, vulnerable as far as to the cold thereafter. But it could have been much worse, correct?
Oh, it could have been much worse. I could have lost digits.
So fingers, what? Right.
What is, for those that don't know, what is your book about, Heaven is Beautiful? And what was your main inspiration behind wanting to share that story?
Well, the book is my journey on this entire expedition, this adventure that we went on, and then my time dead and what happened to me over there and what it was like when I came back. I came back an entirely different person. I changed. I had, Don, you said you went to parochial school. I went to Catholic high school and studied a gospel a year.
You went for 12 years then?
Oh, no, just 1 year. I mean, 4 years, high school. High school only.
Okay, I went just elementary. Okay, parochial, okay.
Yep. And so I went to Catholic high school for 4 years, and I came back with no faith. I know that I am a temporary being and I'm passing through, and I never, ever forget it. And part of the reason I never forget it is because it's always roaring inside me. And part of the message that is always roaring inside me without language, there's like this pressure against a dam. And I was the dam. I resisted pretty strongly after I came back. But the pressure was propelling me to communicate what happened to me. Essentially, I gave you this experience. Now you have to tell everybody about it. And that's the last thing I wanted to do. So I kept it a secret for 20 years, even when I was working in the church. And I eventually came out at the very end of that time in my life. And then I ended up getting recruited to television and radio. And I had this TV spot for 15 years on a couple of NBC stations here in Maine. And I was the inspirational storyteller, and I ended up working in New York, doing a lot of work with Bravo, and not a lot of work, but I touched base with Bravo and Hallmark Channel and a few other places. And I was working with Odyssey Networks. And one night we all went out. It was, okay, I got to set the scene for you here. It was all of the religious communicators from the Baha'i, the Krishnas, the Episcopalians, the Catholics, everybody who's at this table. We're all working in media together. And I had too many drinks that night, and I'm not a drinker, so two drinks and it's too many for me. And I ended up telling my story about what happened to me as I died. And there was like a vote at the table forcing me to write a book. And so I knew that I was going to write eventually. I was an English major. I knew that I'd been working toward telling the story in my head. But I never really actually thought I had the courage to do it because I had to come out.
So why do you believe? Why do you believe for 20 years that you fought this?
Because
you resisted.
I didn't.
You tried to run from it.
Well, I had a paradoxical thing happening. And the paradoxical thing was I kept my mouth shut about it. I resisted it, but I ran to it too.
You were drawn to it.
I was compelled by it. It was more like being caught in a super powerful vacuum that I couldn't resist no matter what I did. So instead of going to architectural graduate school, I ended up going to Yale to study, where I studied mysticism and learned techniques of interior prayer practice, and continued to dive inside myself, continued my inner journey, even though I didn't want the job.
So where did that inner journey eventually take you?
Oh, it took me very deeply. It took me into multiple mystical experiences. It took me into integration here. It took me to television. It took me to radio. It took me to here, sitting here, and to this my international bestseller, which I like to say because I can't believe it happened.
That is an accomplishment in itself, but it also had to be just as gratifying that people were drawn to your story, to your experience, and not because they were just curious, but because they wanted to believe. They wanted to have further verification, validation for things they had heard, possibly things they had experienced within their own families. And it just, I'm sure, helped solidify what they accept as a genuine experience. You accept it as a genuine experience, correct?
I have never for a single moment of my life had any doubt. The thing I love about science, Ellie, is that science doesn't matter if you believe it or you don't. It is or it isn't. Nope. And that's the way it is for me with what happened to me. Mm-hmm. I've never tried to convince anybody of anything. I just tried to tell my story and show them what I experienced the best I'm able to do and let them make their own choice. Because I know that in the end, as soon as they shed this mortal coil, all's well. Mm-hmm. They're going to slip out of this thing and be quite surprised. And I expect them to be pleased.
So, you know, during, I would say, all of this, have you noticed that since your near-death experience that you've been more or less sensitive to supernatural things that might happen around you, or like places or people that have died, or like seeing ghosts or feeling different things that, you know, people have claimed to feel or see, that kind of stuff?
Yeah, and that's one of the reasons why I kept my mouth shut, because I didn't want to lose my credibility with my family or with my friends. And yeah, absolutely. Ghosts and dead people and psychic experiences, all that kind of stuff.
With that question, I have a follow-up question, since that was your answer. What has been the strangest or most awe-inspiring or just scary? Which one has popped out and sticks in your head for those supernatural experiences?
Excluding all of the mystical experiences, all of them. I was a stilt walker for fun. And so I did a lot of parades. I live in a small town on the coast of Maine, and I would do parades because it was fun. And so one day I was late to this parade, and I didn't know where it was going to begin. And so I pulled out my iPad and looked it up. And the first thing that popped up was this article about this guy, this Shriner, who in his little go-kart a year or two before flipped his cart on there's a saltwater river that runs between these two little towns. And it's probably, it might be 40 feet wide, but it's very deep and very powerful. And so he flipped his cart over, and pardon me, I'll say this as gently as possible. He died in front of everyone, and it was, it wasn't pretty. And so I was like, whoa, look at that. And then I had to look up. So I found out where the parade began, and I began this parade, and it was a pumpkin parade. So I was dressed as a corn stalk. I was like a 9-foot corn stalk, and a corn stalk sticking up out of my head. And so I got to the bridge, And I was having fun. Kids were running through my legs and all sorts of stuff like that. It was really fun.
Yeah.
And I saw some of my neighbors. And so I came speeding down this hill and I stopped on one foot right in front of them and took all my momentum and spun toward them, took a huge step and stopped short right at their feet, like towering over the river. Mm-hmm. And they're sitting on the sidewalk. And as I did that, my right stilt broke. And I had this experience of falling over into the river. And I saw myself doing this. And then as I saw myself doing this, I was going to drown. There was like no way I was not going to drown. Mm-hmm. And so as I saw this happening, I was like going forward, my stilt broke. I'm going forward, had all this momentum. Suddenly I popped out of my body, kind of behind me and next to me. And I'm watching the scene now. And next to me is this big gray floating mass. And then I'm back in my body. And instead of going over the edge, I collapse to the floor, to the ground. And all these people gather around me. And a couple of guys were going to dive in the river in front, you know, to save me. It was pretty dramatic. Wow. So I twisted my ankle a little bit. And the stilt broke because I had a faulty bolt. My bolt sheared. The bolt sheared. So I went back. This buddy of mine was there. He's going to jump in and save me. We went back to his car. I kind of limped the whole way on my twisted ankle. And I'm sitting there in the car and my phone rings. And it's this woman who had also been a near-death experiencer. She had been hit by a car on her bike and broke all her every bone in her body kind of thing. And now she was a paramedic paramedic and a biology teacher. And I've been counseling her through her depression, because near-death experience can often come with depression, pretty severe depression. And so for about a year, I counseled her, but I hadn't talked to her in a year. And I'm sitting in the car and the phone rings and it's her. And I'm like, hi. And she said, what just happened to you? I said, what do you mean what just happened to me? She said, well, there's a dead guy here with me telling me that he was trying to help you.
Oh,
and I said, what are you talking about? She said, well, what happened? I explained the situation. And she said, well, he keeps telling me that he was trying to save you. And he thought he could see you. He thought that you could see him. He kept thinking if he could see me seeing. So then he kind of stuck with me, the Shriner, for a couple of weeks, and he was like with me all the time. And finally, he wasn't obnoxious or anything. He was just kind of like a pest. And so I called her up. I said, how do I get rid of this guy? And she said, did you tell him to go to the light? He's stuck. I said, that's all I have to do? She said, yeah, that's all you have to do. So that's what I did. And off he went.
Oh my gosh.
Yeah.
Right. Holy crap. That so in itself is just quite the story.
I know. This is the reason why I don't, you know, now I'm telling these stories, but for decades, I didn't tell these stories because,
right.
You know.
You would have been the best person to talk to at a party, though. Dude, you should have.
I suppose, yeah, maybe so. But I would have got fired from my job. That's for sure.
Okay, fair.
But okay, we've read the account of your experience, your near-death experience, but we want to hear it from you exactly as far as at the moment that you, I mean, did you just black out, or did you even feel that you were thinking to yourself, I'm going to die here, there's nobody who can save me? I've been in that experience where I just resigned myself. I was trapped underwater and I'm going to die here. And until somebody pulled me out. But anyway, so let's hear from you, Peter, as far as what exactly did you experience?
Well, Don, that's kind of what happened to me. I'd been fighting, Tim and I both had been fighting for our survival all night long as we made this traverse and repel and traverse and repel. And we were in north of Banff. It was March. There's 10 feet of snow on the ground. And I don't know what the temperature was because I didn't have a thermometer that I could read, but it was well below freezing, well below zero, mm-hmm. zero Fahrenheit. And it kept getting colder through the night. So when it finally happened, we were 100 feet up. Clifton, there was a, we were first time all night harnessed into the mountain, strapped into the mountain. There was some rappel pins where we were. And but the rope was stuck and irremovable. I couldn't release the rope. There was nothing I could do about it. So after fighting all night for our survival, I just gave up. I just recognized hypothermia went to this position where this place where I unzip my coat, which is, you know, naked people are found in the snow because it feels like you get hot. And so I unzipped my coat and it accelerated the process. And I started falling asleep and I'd smack on the rock and stand back up again. And then I stood back up this last time and I had this feeling of, I guess I'm going to die. I guess there's no way out of this. And then I had the tunnel vision, and this tunnel vision began collapsing on me. And as it was getting down to nothing, I kept thinking, what is this weird thing that's happening to me? And where's my vision going? And I must be falling asleep. And when it went to black, I didn't fall asleep. I woke up. Everything was black and dark, and suddenly all my pain was gone, and I didn't know where the mountain had gone. And in front of me, instead of the mountain, there was this expanse of darkness that was the size of the galaxy, and it was all black. And at the way far, at the furthest distance, a tiny pinprick of light, like a star, appeared and came rushing toward me. And as it rushed toward me, it filled my vision and it communicated to me, I'm taking you. And I was like, I don't know what's going on here, but I'm not going anywhere, staying right where I am. And it just took me. And as it took me, it enfolded me and surrounded me. And I was inside of this this transparent orb. And it was massive, and it was communicating to me, and not language, but it was communicating to me in its intelligence and its power and its longevity. And I could tell that it was a reduction of a much larger entity. It was sort of in two, it was superpositioned, but it wasn't equally superpositioned. It was a million percent on one end and 2% on the other. And the other end was still gigantic comparison to me. And I was encased in this, and my physical body had gone, and I was still human shaped, but I was made of light. And everything I'm saying is photons. I mean, everything I'm saying is metaphors. So when I say photons, I don't really mean the photon. I mean, that's kind of what it looked like. And so I'm inside of this entity, and it's sweeping me back up the way it came. And as I'm being swept up, I'm being fed comfort and wellness and well-being. And I can see through it into this dark void. And I can see me in it, looking out. So I've got this other, I'm superpositioned. I have I'm an eye outside of this entity, a kind of a God's eye view, watching me travel back to where it had come from. And I could see this, simultaneously. So I had two points of view, but when I looked from the inside to the outside eye, I couldn't see me. And then the next thing I knew is that this gigantic orb reached a limit, and at this limit it unfolded itself, and I popped out of it into a much greater void, an oceanic womb. And in this oceanic womb of darkness that was also illuminated, it was paradoxical, I was now the orb of consciousness, 10,000 times bigger than my human body. And my thinking was my being. There was no separation. Like I have a brain, I have fingertips, and I feel with these, and I think with that. I was one entity. My thinking was my being, was my self-understanding. And what I understood was, this is me. This is the true me. This has always been the true me. I was never that human being, not real. That was a temporary situation. I'm back to myself again. And I can see the darkness in every single direction, and the darkness extends the size of the universe, and at the edge of the universe, and I can see all of it, but there's nothing there but me. It's no thingness. There are no molecules. There's no quarks. There's no energy. There's no matter. It is emptiness, nothingness, and I am made of nothingness, this consciousness that I am. And way far at the edge of this is a darkness that I can't see into. It's a darker darkness that was the sort of the container of all of this vastness. And I was content. I was content and happy and knew myself for who I was. And as I was in this state, an opening, the darkness opened, ripped and down poured this waterfall of white light. And this white light was like a million times bigger than me. It's gigantic. In the book, I give it a size and a measurement, but it's just much bigger than me. And it's white flowing light. But it's also, again, simultaneously, every single color in the spectrum of visible and electromagnetic radiation, everything. It's all these different tiny pixelates of color, but it's not flipping between white and pixelization. It's both at the same time. And it's them and one, and it's the most beautiful beauty I'd ever seen. And I wanted it. And it moved toward me. And as soon as I wanted it, I moved toward it with the motion of thought. And I touched it with my being. And as I touched it with my being, it flowed into me. It flowed into me and surrounded me and expanded me. And then all these things happened at the same time. I heard my soul name being called, my original self, my constantly being called into being name. So I wasn't made once. I'm always being made. I'm always being created. I had a life review. And in my life review, I went through all of the pain that I'd given away in my life from the interior perspective of everybody I gave it to, simultaneous with my own point of view. And the juxtaposition of those two and the amount of pain I felt, their emotions and their chemical reactions and their anger and jealousy and surprise and hurt. But I also felt my reasons and my emotions, and they were this big, and the pain that I gave them was gigantic, and the pain that I gave them all accrued to me. And it was as if this eye was seeing all of my shadow self. That there was nothing about me that had been hidden, that I had hidden, that remained hidden. It was just all seen. And there was no judgment coming from this light. It was just showing me myself. And in the comparison of my smallness, my weakness, my propensity to give pain, in comparison to this purity of just love, I judged myself as less than, as shamed, as shameful and guilty.
Isn't that an interesting kind? I mean, that before, I mean, when you were still in the midst of all the darkness, that you already felt comfort, that you were already receptive of your fate at that moment. And that even in this position of, like, as people would describe, seeing their life flash before their eyes, that type of thing, at such a moment, that it all comes back to you for all the pain that one inflicts on others, whether intentional or not, but that you still felt no judgment, that it was like, okay, this is your life, and that you become the judge, that you look back and that you're able to discern between the good and the bad, and that becomes your awareness, your illumination. The idea that I get a second chance, and that's what we're coming to in a moment here.
And so
when you get sent back.
So, well, yeah. Yes. And so when I was going through this judgment, this self-judgment, it was expressing love to me. I knew you through all of this, every single decision that I made, every single action that I took, it was telling me that I was beloved, even though this love for me was always and eternal, and that the divine was present with me and with the other person, and was indeed the other person and me, and experiencing my life and their lives through the body. and that forgiveness was on offer the entire time. So it's speaking love to me, love to me, love to me, love to me. And all I had to do was accept it. And once I turned toward it, I inflated with it, and I was infilled with paradise, bliss, beauty, wholeness, healing, understanding, joy, knowledge, intelligence, awe, paradise, love, light. And all of these were one thing, truth. They were one thing. And they blew me up like a balloon. And I became, I inflated to the point where a little bit more would have obliterated the remaining separation between the fullness of the oneness and what was left of me. And I felt like I would have become it. And then I deflated again. Just before that, I deflated again, had this union experience. And then I said, and I should tell you this. I saw a whole bunch of incarnations that I had lived. I saw basically an oversoul that lived all of these, was living all these incarnations, because they were, from my point of view, simultaneous, even though they were in a sequence. They were all happening when I was there. And then there was the me that was the most pure me that was watching all of this. And the most pure me was like, a single photon from an infinite field of photons of intelligence. And I was outside of that field, but superpositioned with it. And so I was part of it, but separate from it, limited, a limited form of the unlimited. And I recognized that none of the incarnations that I had lived were me. They were all temporary places that I had lived, but not me at all. I was allowed to see into two of them. And then when this part was over, and I'm speeding the story along here, when this part was over, I kind of I reduced back to a smaller self with memory of my recent life. And I said to the divine, and the divine is this voice that's inside of me and all around me. This whole place is the divine. This infinite space that I'm in, all of it is the divine self. And it says to me, I say to it, am I dead? And it says, yeah, you're dead. And I say, well, I can't die now. You know, my parents, we lost my sister. It devastated my mom. What are my parents going to do if they lose me? And so when I said that, I got swept across this infinitely large universe space to an edge. And I know how that it's like, how can it be infinite and have an edge? But I don't know. It's just, it's all full of paradox. And so I got swept across this space, and part of me was kind of tucked out through this. And these days I call it like a Higgs boson field, where energy becomes matter. So I'm like, I'm the energy, and I'm suddenly in the place of matter with my little eyeball sticking out into the universe. And I can see our entire universe. I can see all these galaxies and the distances between them, these vast spaces. And my attention is brought back, like aimed back to the Big Bang, to the origin of the universe. And it wasn't just the Big Bang itself. It was the always Big Bang. It's always the energy of the light flowing out into all things and make them exist. And there was that darkness that was impenetrable to me. And out of this impenetrable darkness, I saw all this light pouring out, and this light wove itself into the universe in every single molecule that there is. And I could see the light move. I could see the light, the universe being born from this light energy, and that the light energy was subsumed or beneath the material form and was in everything. Stars and planets and galaxies and everything. Everything was made of this light. And as I looked, the darkness was pouring out this light, weaving it into our entire universe. More universes were popping out, like universe after universe after universe after universe, just kind of spilling out, going above and above and above, just hundreds of them. And this immense vastness spoke to me. And as it spoke to me, it said, in the way that I love you now, and that all of this light that was pouring out, that was inside of everything, there was love itself, and born of the love that is the light, and even greater is the darkness out of which the light poured. This immense love poured out, and it was aimed right at me. And all of the love that ever was aimed at me. And it said, in the way I love you now, I have always loved you and always will love you. And because of my love, all has been well, all will be well, and all is well. And it showed me that that was true for all of the universe. And as I watched this and experienced this immense, infinite, unconditional love that was just expansive to me, my vision was focused on Earth and kind of zoomed in on Earth. And Earth was like a huge hologram with every human being living on it. It wasn't like a picture of the Earth. It was like the Earth with every person on it. And I could see them all night and day. And I could zoom in on people. And inside of every single person was this golden light, this little tiny fleck of golden light. And it was blocked from the vision of everybody. Nobody could see it but me, because there was this big fog or foam around the Earth between people. And the voice said, I love everyone. Everyone, the way that I love you now, I love everyone. And I could see terrible, bad people doing bad things and people doing good things. And there was no person who was not beloved, and because the whole universe is beloved, and that all will fold back into me and nothing is ever lost. And so don't worry about your parents, because they're going to be fine. And then my parents' faces showed up, and like a mom and dad, and then mom and dad again. Two sets of moms, two sets of dads. And in the first set of mom and dad, I could see the whole of their lives without me. Like if I don't go back, I can see devastation. And when my mom and my dad and my sister and my brother, everybody's ruined. And then I could see if I go back. And if I go back, the suffering is still there, but it's a lot less. Like it's not, you know, I've lost another child and my mom is shattered into a million pieces.
Right.
But their ends were the same. Their deaths were different, but after they died, they were with me. And this whole thing, I saw that the length of every life is the wink of an eye, the snap of a finger. And the voice said, if you wait just a moment, we'll have lived this life, this terrible life, and we'll be here and they'll be in paradise with you now, here. And I said, yeah, but look at that, you know, that's awful. And can I go back and, you know, so that they don't have to experience that. And the voice said, yeah, you can go back. I said, well, if I go back, can I come back here to this bliss? And the voice said, yes. And I said, well, I choose to live my life. And it said, you won't live your life. And it threw me out. And I was back inside this angelic being compressed. And then suddenly in front of me, there were a million choices, doorways of life, all leading back to my body. But there were all these different lives I could live. And in the center of all these doorways was one huge big beam of white light that I could see emanating from the darkness and illuminating the doors in a decreasing luminosity out to the furthest edges. And the voice said to me, choose light. And I thought to myself, well, if I'm going back and I have to be a messenger, and I'd been working in construction, going to college, but working in construction, I was going to be an architect. And I thought, well, I gotta have some flaws. I can't be perfect. And so I made all these choices in an instant, and this door opened and down the tunnel I went. And inside of this tunnel were 10,000 doors, and these doors all led to the other tunnels, and they were all choices. And all of these doorways, all of these tunnels were all probabilities for me living my life, and they were all interconnected. And so I went down this one tunnel and I got to the end of it with this angelic being. And I could see, as I said, these two bodies. And when I was hanging off the cliff, but I didn't know it was me. And I saw this other body shaking this first body, and I didn't know it was Tim. And then this angelic being, it pierced my chest, this body's chest, and opened it up and shoved me in, and it crushed me down. I became so small and stuffed me inside. And now I'm stuck inside this thing, and I can still see out, and I can see the angelic being, and I can see the light, and I can see heaven. And it closed. And as it closed, I was like trapped in this tomb, and my brain started coming. I felt my brain come back online, like whirring up like an electric motor. And then my hearing came back, And I felt my body shaken and suffering came back. I had no suffering when I was dead. Zero, zippo, wholeness and healing and wellness of being, so much so that suffering was completely forgotten. And now I'm back in this terrible, terrible tomb. And I can hear this voice, this noise, and it resolves into to a language, and it's don't die, don't die, don't die, don't die. And it's screaming and yelling. And I open my eyes and there is Tim. He's like bending over me, shaking me. And he's still saying, don't die, don't die, don't die. And then he sees me open my eyes and he's like, you were dead. You were dead. You were dead. I thought you were dead. Are you going to die? I'm going to die. And he pulls me up and I'm completely disoriented because I don't even know where I am. I don't know who I am. I don't know who he is. I don't know what's going on. All I know is that I was in exile, that I had been to this other place and that I had made this choice. And now I was stuck here. And it was all this fragileness, thinness, brokenness, and that I was not completely in my body, that I was looking at the world through this, what's felt like a biological robot to me. And after a little time, my memory came back. And Tim explained that I had to pull the rope, and I did. And because maybe a miracle, maybe because of the angle I fell off the cliff, which seems to be more likely, the rope came free on the first pull. We descended. And because the ice climb was on the Icefields Parkway, not far from the car, we got our tent, set up our tent and self-treated for hypothermia, brought our temperatures back up, eventually got in the car sometime around sunrise. And I was an entirely different person.
You had to be hospitalized, I would imagine.
Oh, no. Oh, no, 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 no.
But you weren't.
This is 1980. We're in the middle of the wilderness. I was a college student.
Remember, even with frostbite, they would say, well, just run water on it.
Yeah.
Just warm it up. Just bring it back to room temperature, that type of thing.
I was on the ski patrol, and so I relied. That's one of the reasons why we were out there, is because I knew what to do in the wilderness, first aid, and so we treated ourselves, and I didn't think we needed hospitalization.
Mm-hmm. Wow!
But did you ever ask? Okay, you brought me back. You sent me back. I was able to come back. I asked if I could go back, but why did I go back to? That all that pain.
I was upset.
Did you regret it?
In the moment that I came back, and then for the next 20 years, I prayed every day. I practiced Kriya Yoga and centering prayer, and as I practiced those two practices, I had a third practice, which was, "Take me home today. I don't want to be here anymore."
Yeah.
Wow. That's
amazing. But there are many days you don't feel that way, I'm sure.
Oh, no, I felt that way every single day until I died again in 2015 of a heart attack.
Right.
And so after that, I chose to come back again, this time for my granddaughter. Family circumstances were such that it was better if I was here than not here. And so I had a choice and I came back again. And from that day on, I haven't been praying for my own death. It's coming. You know, third time's a charm, I hope. But for the meantime, I'm going to stick around as long as I can for them.
So you say something in your book that, if you could just explain it really quick, that you don't believe in trees and birds and things. You just know they exist, that you don't have faith in them. How does that relate to a normal person where I can see trees and birds and I'm like, oh yeah, I know they exist because they're right there. I could squeeze them or touch them or fall out of them. How does that relate? It made me extremely curious.
Well, I have this weird relationship with animals and plants. I animals like me. Like I have, this is the God's honest truth. Mm-hmm. I have chickadees and red squirrels and chipmunks. And ducks, who are my buddies today, right now, where I live. Mm-hmm. They're my friends. They're my neighbors. We hang out. They visit me in my studio. So it's
not
that
pets are wild.
Yeah, they're wild.
Okay.
It's not that they don't exist. It's that nothing here is real. Everything here is temporary. There's nothing here that is permanent, not even the universe itself. Okay. Everything that's in the universe, well, maybe the universe will last for infinity, but I don't think so because it doesn't. No. I saw infinity. It's like it's infinite. Mm-hmm. But everything else here is, it's in Hindus call Maya. It's the illusion, but it's also Maya is also the energy that makes the illusion. And so it's this temporary thin thing. And so when I communicate, I talk to the animals all the time. I don't always understand what they're saying. I'm not Dr. Doolittle. Okay. But I know when they knock on my door. The squirrel was knocking on my door today. And I know that they're just like me. Everything here is just like me, the tree, temporary. The rock, everything. Well, not only temporary, but made of light. Mm-hmm. And so there's this relationship that supersedes the physicality. And it's not something that's intellectual. I haven't intellectualized this. I experience it. I see it. I feel it. It's this thing that's always with me. But also, yeah, everything is totally temporary, especially me. And so that gives me a lot of freedom. And I'll also say this about plants and birds and animals is we have an acre of land here on the coast of Maine, and it's a microhabitat. We have mink and we had moose walking by. We had, you know, all sorts of animals coming in here all the time. We cultivate it for butterflies and dragonflies and bees in particular. They're real. They're just not permanent.
Even the stars have an expiration date.
Oh, mm-hmm. Yeah, they do. Everything does, as far as we can, as far as we know, right?
So do you have, Peter, do you have this sense of urgency that you still, I mean, you're here, but again, it's temporal. It's something that each day is one day less. And as much as you feel that you're ready, that you know what's beyond, I'm sure you even feel drawn.
Oh, I'm totally
at
drawn.
Times. But you're also here to finish the job, so to speak. You're here. You have a mission.
I do.
Especially given that you've been sent back a couple of times now.
I do have a mission.
Do you believe that your mission is for family or to educate people on what is out there? Or like?
It's twofold.
Okay.
It's twofold, Ellie. It's my family. I helped my dad had in the end, my dad had a 3-year terrible death. He died 2 years ago.
Oh.
And now my mom, we just moved her into assisted living. She had a stroke. And so focus on my mom and my dad to help them. I don't live near them though. They live in Southern New England. And my granddaughter, I'm here to help her as best I can. Mm-hmm. No father in the family. And, but I also have this other thing. So it's twofold. I'm here to try to help my mom and my dad and my granddaughter, my kids.
Mm-hmm.
But I also have this other thing. And that other thing is to try as best I can to communicate that which is unspeakable. And so I studied communication. I was an English major, mm-hmm. learned how to write and then learned how to think in graduate school, studied in order to become a storyteller, to be able to tell stories, and studied mysticism in order to use words to communicate mm-hmm. the experience. But that's only on this level. There's another level underneath it, which is the real level for me, which is the place of the divine energy itself. The what Christians call it, the Holy Spirit. Some people call it chi, some call it prana. It has all these different names, but it's this divine energy that is, a person can accumulate it mm-hmm. and then distribute it. And so, and if one negates one's attachment to oneself and mm-hmm. cultivates a space for the presence of the prana to create a barrel for it in which to be stored, it can then be distributed. And so I'm really trying to show people to help them experience this as best I'm able to do so that they can feel it inside themselves. And when you feel it inside yourself, then you know that it's one, real, and that two, it's in you. And then if you can find this energy inside yourself, you don't really need anyone or anything else. You don't really need doctrine or dogma. What you do need is practice, you know, some kind of meditative practice in order to cultivate it. But it is who we are. And if I can communicate that thing, and I'm just doing a small part. There are 10 to 20 million near-death experiencers, your dad included, in the United States today. Expand mm-hmm. that around the world, because of primarily because of the onset of cardiac care in the 1960s, and the spread of life-saving resuscitation. Mm-hmm. We are a phenomena. There are more people like us now alive than have ever been. There's always been near-death experiencers, but we're all like these little diodes of light at the end of a fiber optic cable. And maybe together we can help nudge humanity towards a future unlike its past, because in its past, we've always been necessarily tribal, because that's how societies survived, and the individual reliance upon the tribe. But we're up against each other's shoulders here now, and we're one planet with one communication system. And maybe now we have an opportunity to stop the trajectory of planetary destruction and the end of human life.
We're all unique. And yet we're all connected. And then that ultimate connection, that if we accept that we're all connected to the divine, as you describe it. And as you describe it, you wax poetic in describing it, not only by what you observed, by how you felt at each moment, what you experienced as far as physically, mentally. And many are only able to describe, you know, what vision they experience. If they saw loved ones at the end of the tunnel, so to speak, if they recognized a father, a mother, a sister, a brother, that type of thing. But your gift, Peter, is the fact that you are able to even describe the level of compassion, that level of love, and that you could feel it. I can feel it just looking at you as far as on the screen, but you express it and it comes through. It's something that people, I'm sure they want to share it with you. And that's a gift. And whether you had it before or it's something that you acquired through these experiences, it's something that you now feel that you need to share, that you need to complete, you know, that divine mission that you were assigned. And what could you have waiting for you? Look what we all hopefully have waiting for us.
Can't wait.
And isn't that just the ultimate? To get through this life, this is hell for many people. It's hell for all of us in one respect or another. And so anybody, I pity those who feel this is it. This is it. This is as good as it gets. Well, I'm sorry. You're setting your bar pretty low.
They'll find out.
Well, I know we need to wrap things up. I have just one really quick question. Since, you know, you were up there and you said that you kind of got to see your past or other kind of selves, do you believe that you'll be going straight back to that place when you die? Or do you think that you'll be reincarnated to once again come back?
I don't know that those are mutually exclusive.
No, I don't think so. But maybe a part of yourself will come back.
But a part of myself was in all of those mm-hmm. incarnations, but then none of them were me. And I, most of my life, I was like, I'm not coming back to this freaking place. You can't make me come. That was part of my argument. You can't make me come back. Right. And, Chris, who knows? I don't know how the deal works over there. If I have to come back, I come back. But I've had multiple other experiences in between these two near-death experiences. And what I've come to understand about myself, and I think this is true for everybody, but I know that this is true for me, that my aim is to end my separation. and that to become re-enfolded into the divine light itself. And so all of my interior mystical practice, my Kriya Yoga, my Sunrise Prayer, my service to other people, and that's what ministry was for me, was helping people. That's what I did. It was my job. And all of that had to do with self-negation. And the self-negation isn't just about my human form and my egoic self, but it's all the layers of my soul until I peel away enough of it to be enfolded back into the oneness of being, which is really all I want.
That's fantastic. Is there any last words you'd like to share with everybody, or would you like to tell people how they can find you and get your book?
Both those things. All you need is love. You don't have to have any meditation life. You just love and care for the people around you. And you don't even have to be a believer. It doesn't really matter. If you're a loving and caring person, you're doing the right thing. Being kind as often as you can. Yeah. Automatically. Yeah. It's built into us, you know? Look at the atheist mother who loves her baby. And, you know?
What? And her friends and family and what she'll go through for them.
Right exactly. Right. All you need is love, because love is the only thing that there is. I'm at peterpanagore.love. I have a YouTube channel, and I help people who have had mystical experiences, spiritually transformative experiences, reintegrate into their lives. And this is an ongoing thing. It's not like, oh, I'm reintegrated now. It's like new things. So peterpanagore.love. My book is available globally. It's an Audible international bestseller. It's been optioned for a movie. I've been working on that today. Working on that for the last 3 years. They optioned my next book for a sequel. And so I'm hoping that my contract will be completed for this movie by the end of January. And then they'll move. Then the producers will, you know, they're off and running.
That's fantastic. And that book is Heaven is Beautiful, everybody.
You'll be touching millions and millions of more people. Isn't that fantastic? I have to ask you one last thing. Were you died the first time? Did you ever go back there just to see?
Oh, I did. I didn't want to. I people were like, did you ever go back there? I'm like, I'm never going back to that place. Not ever, ever, ever. Right. It's all full of trauma for me. After the book came out, I was this sugar mama who she came to a reading and she's fabulous. She bought me an airline ticket. She paid for the top of the line SUV, paid for all my food and all my hotels, and sent me back. And a buddy came with me. Wow. And so in 2016, we went back and we met with some Native American elders who my friend was connected with out there, and they helped me, as they said, call my soul back, face my shadow, face my trauma. And I faced my trauma. I went to the mountains, and in December, right now, actually, right now is the time of year I was there in 2016, and I came back. And until 2016, when I told my story, it was a traumatic experience for me to every single time I told it. It was dark and scary and made me cry. But afterwards, I had faced some of my shadow, my trauma from the night. And I returned not seeing I always looked at the mountain in my mind as this like terrible dark place. And after going there and facing my own shadow side, the doorway back mattered more. I could see the doorway back here open to the light. And so my whole experience and understanding of what happened to me transformed.
Right.
Wow.
Makes you wonder who she was, doesn't it?
Oh, I know who she is. She lives down the coast from me. So she totally took care of me though. She was great.
That is awesome.
Sounds like she's a guardian angel in many respects.
Oh, she did. She changed my life.
Another level.
Yeah, she did. Yes, she totally. Good for both of you.
Thank you, Peter, so much for being our guest this evening. You've been a delight to speak with.
Thanks, Ellie. Thanks a lot. I appreciate it. Don.
All right, everybody, that's what we've got for you this evening. And I really hope that you will find this episode, rate and review it. It helps other people find us. And be sure to follow us on our social medias. You can find us on Facebook and Instagram at noearthlyexplanation.com. If you'd like to follow me, you can find me at Ellie Ringo and at Ellie Knows Rocks. If you'd like to follow Don, you can find him on Facebook at Donald Raymond Schmidt. And if you would like to send us any kind of an email or give us future suggestions for episodes you would like us to investigate, you can email us at noearthlyexplanation@gmail.com. Thank you guys so much once again for listening, and we'll see you on the next one.
Goodbye, all. And thank you once again to our wonderful guest, Peter. And we'll see you next time, Ellie. Bye-bye.
Bye.
Metacortex Publishing hopes that you've enjoyed this presentation.
Please take a moment to listen to some other podcast offerings from Metacortex Publishing.
Hi, I'm Father Daniel Duplantis, a Catholic priest, martial artist, and host of the Karate Priest podcast. Have you ever wondered what the church teaches about different topics? Are you a martial arts enthusiast or just someone who wants to learn more about martial arts? I'd like to invite you to join me and many guests on my podcast as we cover topics of faith, everyday living, and martial arts on the Karate Priest podcast.
A quest is a search for something. And every week, the Quest podcast will show you how we know what we know through interviews with people that have incredible stories of dedication and perseverance. I'm your host, Todd Fisher. Join me in this thought-provoking and inspiring podcast of discovery. Find us anywhere you listen to podcasts.
Everybody, I'm Amber Rose, the religious hippie, and I host the podcast A Catholic's Perspective. Join me every 2 weeks as I release episodes targeted towards helping young Catholics navigate their ever-changing secular world while staying strong in their faith. Whether you are a Catholic or not, all are welcome here. So if this is something that interests you, feel free to tune in. You can find A Catholic's Perspective on Spotify, Apple, or wherever you listen to your podcasts. I hope to see you there. Bye!
Thank you for listening to this podcast. Please be sure to rate and review this episode. This podcast is produced by Todd Fisher and Anthony Smith and is distributed by Metacortex Publishing. This podcast is copyright. Any previously trademarked or copyright content is used by permission. Information and opinions stated in this podcast should not be construed as medical advice. Please be sure to visit the official website for Metacortex Publishing at metacortexpublishing.com or find us on social media for other unique content.